Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. On our way to this conversation about the Unger decision and the men and one woman who were released from prison after decades and decades in prison because of something that happened that we'll get into. We're here today to talk about what has happened after that time to the men who have come out. And we're going to explore that in a minute. On the way there, I have to remind you of something, though, before I forget, which I don't forget because part of the reason we're here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we are here with Walter Lomax, who has been on the show numerous times. Walter Mandela Lomax is executive director of the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, part of Fusion Partnerships. He is joined today here in the studio by Stanley Mitchell, one of the men who was released because of the Unger decision. Stanley, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And two of the women who are working with the men who come out, and this whole project is going on, Rebecca Bowman-Rivas, LCSWC, licensed social, clinical social worker, law and social work service program manager for the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and Joni Shreve, who is an LGSW on her way to get that C, licensed clinical social worker, also the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, and good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
And please join us here, 410-319-8888. You can email us at talkatsteinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. So, Walter, take us back first to the where this began with the Unger decision, what that was about, and how it led to the release of how many people.
Okay. First, thank you for inviting us back.
Always good to see you.
I recall shortly after the Unger people began to be released, and you invited us on the program to talk about it because of the misperception of how they were being released. And how this all started is that in 2012, the Court of Appeals here in Maryland issued a landmark decision called the Unger decision. And what that entailed was that anyone who was tried and convicted by a jury prior to 1980 had received erroneous jury instructions and that they were entitled to a new trial. And in 2013, individuals began to be released. And initially, there was a lot of negative publicity surrounding their release. It was said that there was a lot of talk being talked about the crime that they committed and the circumstances of the crime rather than the individuals that they were today. And when we came on the program, we had an opportunity initially to talk about how they are, the individuals that they are today. And that's why we asked to come back today. One is because since 2013, we have, I just found out this morning, I thought it was at least over 40, that at least 50 people have been released. And since their release, we've not had one single violation where someone has committed another crime. It was perceived that they would be a threat to public safety. It has been clearly demonstrated over time that they have not been a threat to public safety and that they have become assets to their community. In fact, shortly after current state's attorney Marilyn Mosby won the election, we had a meeting with her office and her staff to assure her that this was not something that we was dealing with from an adversarial position, that we, in fact, wanted to partner with the office to make sure that any individuals that they decide to release, that we would assure their successful transition. And to date, that partnership has worked because not one single person has their office released, has violated. And what's really more telling about that is that a vast majority of these individuals had been recommended for parole over an extended period of time and had all been denied. And in fact, in 2012, Governor O'Malley denied over 50-some petitions. And of those petitions, parole recommendations and commutation petitions that he denied, at least 24 of those individuals who have been released under the Unger decision were amongst those that had been denied in 2012, and they're doing great work since their release back into the community. They've not been a threat, not whatsoever. What's also really telling is that if you do the math, roughly it costs roughly $38,000 a year to house an individual serving this type of sentence. And we were talking prior to coming on is that when you factor in the age, that we're being generous by using that $38,000 because that could substantially increase to $75,000 to $100,000. But we just used the math and say if you use over a one-year period using that $38,000, that's over $5 million that was saved at that point. And if you calculate it over a three-year period since 2013, we're talking upward to $15 million or something. And now we are approaching the third-year anniversary, May the 13th, which is important for us to come back at this stage because when you talk about what the statistics is on for an individual that's been released from incarceration to recidivate, that it's in that year, 18 months to three-year period. And when we went to Annapolis to advocate on behalf of a change in the current policy, life means life, we were told that, well, they haven't been out that long. Well, we are here to say that they have been out that long now, so they've already passed your statistical analysis on when a person would recidivate. And so they're still out and they're still doing great. And another important factor that I'd like to make, because I really would like for Mr. Mitchell Ms. Reeves to speak, is that the class action lawsuit that the ACLU just filed on behalf of the juveniles, and it's to say is that these individuals are still being held incarcerated purely for political reasons, but they don't have the Unger issue. And what we are saying is that there is no reason why these individuals would not return. If they were to be released, they would do the same thing that the over 150 people who've been released under the Unger decision would do if they were to return.
We're talking about people who – this new thing we were going to talk a little bit about later in the program with you and later next week is that there's a move afoot by the ACLU that you're involved with, Walter, that teenagers – juveniles who were convicted and given life sentences, people trying to overturn that saying that juveniles should not be given life sentences. And most of these men have been in jail now for 20, 30, 40 years and to get them released and to have them back in the community.
Exactly.
That's what this is.
Exactly.
So I'm going to come back to all that because I think this raises a lot of issues in my mind about our system of justice and what we're here for. I'm going to come back to that those issues. And I want to introduce folks to Stanley Mitchell. I appreciate you taking the time to come in. I know all you guys are really busy now with your new lives. But just talk a bit about the readjustment process for you. I mean, this coming – you were in jail for how long?
I did 35 years.
Long time.
10 months, 19 days, and 11 hours.
Every man comes out has the same answer,
yes,
down to the T,
yes,
that,
yes,
down to the hour, right?
I didn't count until after I got out. To realize how long I was actually gone, because when you're doing it, you're so worried about survival mm-hmm. that you really don't keep track of the time.
While you're inside, you mean?
Right. And I was released June the 20th. I was in the first, second group, the Baker's Dozen, 13 of us. And I was released June the 20th with $18 and 30 days worth of blood pressure medication and told to have a good life, and that's what I've been trying to do. It hasn't been easy, but I've been blessed that I have a strong family that's always been with me. So as a result, I've always known that somebody cared whether I lived or died when I was in prison. And when I came home, I have, you know, a wife. I have a daughter.
Were you married before you went inside?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Yes, sir. And they have helped me adjust, and I have an extended family. You know, I have a family with the University of Maryland Social Work Department. I can always call on them for any assistance because when I came home, I didn't know how to do simple things like pay a parking meter. You know, you got to put the money in now and put the slip on the box. I didn't know nothing about credit. I didn't know nothing about no bank account. These things were foreign to me because I didn't have to deal with them, you know, all the years I was incarcerated. So I had strong family support, and that is what made me be able to adjust to the person I am today. And also I had strong support from the church that I attend. My day is starts at 5 and it ends like 8 now. I keep myself busy. I had to.
What's your day like?
Well, I get up at 5. I'm out the door probably about 6. I It's hard to get a job when you're 67 years old.
That's not easy.
Even though while I was in prison, I graduated from college. I took every course you could possibly take. When I came home, I had some medical issues, but after I got out, I got the proper treatment, and obviously I'm much better now. But like I said, like you asked, my day starts at 5. I'm out the door at 6. I have a transportation business where I take people where they got to go, doctor's appointments. I work along with my wife, Stu, does real estate, and I go with her on appointments to make sure that nobody's in the house, mainly for security. And I just been trying to stay one step ahead of the eviction man, stay one step ahead of the repo man like everybody else. They told me when I was in prison that everybody has a number. I found it when he came on the street, you still have a number. That's credit score. So it's been difficult. It's been extremely difficult. I mean, there's been times when, you know, I didn't know how I was going to pay the rent, how I was going to pay a car note. But like I said, when you're doing the right thing, it seems that people tend to assist you. I'm not going to say I've had my hiccups since I've been home. I wasn't familiar with this red light camera stuff like everybody else I've had, and certain rules of society has changed after 3 decades in prison.
Right.
And so I've had some minor hiccups, but I wouldn't trade for where I'm, you know, I'm more appreciative of life now. Before I went to prison, to be honest with you, I pretty much did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do. Then for the next 35 years, I did what somebody else told me to do. Now I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. So.
Yeah, I read a story of one person that told a story about even going out to get dinner for the first few times and had this lobster dinner. It was all filled up with his food and felt really good, but then didn't know what to do because he expected somebody to tell him to get up and leave, and he was just sitting. And it's just that adjustment of coming out after 35 years.
When I first came home, I was asking people, can I go to the bathroom? They said, yeah, if you got to go. So, used to somebody telling you, you know, literally when you can go to the bathroom, where you can go to the bathroom. Now, so it was a major adjustment. You felt, when I first came home, I felt like everybody was staring at you, that, you know, you were out of place, like you had a sign on your forehead, like the Scarlet Letter.
Right, right.
But as I said, you know, I had a family, an extended family. Like, there's always, I could always call my mentor, who's Walter, who's told me that it's difficult, it's going to be difficult, but his favorite word is it's doable. And so that's what I'm learning. It is doable. It's not easy, but it's doable. If you really desire to do the right thing, you can. It hasn't been easy, but you know, I'm glad to where I'm at today.
Well, I'm glad you are.
It's difficult to get employment, regardless how many degrees you got behind your name. I'm still, in some people's mind, a convicted murderer that got out on a technicality. You know, I'm not going to even get into my case personally, but I'm just saying that the fact of the matter is that the court and my attorney, who's Michael Middleton, said that you can't trust the verdict on none of these cases. So it's not a technicality. It's the law if you believe in the law. So I'm here, and I'm trying to, you know, do the right thing. My days are spent doing what everybody else does. I go to work, pay bills, play my numbers in the 7-Eleven, things like that. You know, take family members to the doctor, and I'm trying to be a good father, a good husband, good uncle, a good church member, and a member of the community.
So, folks, we're going to have these phone calls coming in a minute at 410-319-8888. And I'll wait to introduce the other two people on the panel here. I think we indicate very quickly that Walter himself, you spent 43 years in prison, right? Is that, have that number right?
No, 39.
39.
Almost 40.
They meant to give you more. Sorry about that. Sorry about that, man. 39. And 2 years ago had your conviction overturned.
Yeah, I prevailed on the petition of actual innocence. Yeah.
Right, so that's important to put out there. So yeah. And Walter has dedicated his life now to the men and women coming out of prison to help, and also works very hard in working for reforms politically in our criminal justice system. So he's been deeply involved in all these things. I just wanted to say that. So who should we go to first? Well, I'm looking at you, so we'll go right
sure.
There. So Joni, tell us about the work that you all are doing and how you're involved in this process.
So I'm a social worker at the Public Defender's Office. And when this all came about in end of 2012, 2013, and we knew these cases were going to be coming back up, Mike Milliman and some of the other attorneys that were on this early on knew that social work was going to be a big part of these cases. And so we developed a team, and we have social workers at the Public Defender's Office and social workers at the University of Maryland Law Clinic who we started working with individuals who had this issue and helping them develop a release plan. One of the questions was, with this group of people affected by this decision, what would happen to them if they were to be released? So we started engaging in conversations with our clients, learning about what their experiences were, how they ended up in prison, what they did in that time, and what their needs were going to be when they came out. So we started with this assessment, and we put together a plan. And as we started getting hearing dates and we started seeing people being welcomed home, we had to put that plan into action. One of the things that we've developed over the last 3 years is providing a support meeting for family members prior to those hearings, and counseling and talking with our clients prior to release about some of the challenges they may experience in the first couple weeks after release, first couple months after release, and then long term. Stanley hit on a couple things that we've seen happen in the immediate transition after release is those physical symptoms that can come about, the feeling like people might be looking at you, sitting down to a big dinner and maybe not agreeing with you. They're very physical symptoms that happen immediately after release. After that sort of initial period, there's a lot of connecting. You know, you're going from a facility where everything is provided to you under one roof to having to engage with a number of agencies and institutions in the community that all have their different rules, all have a different system of calling and waiting and applying and intake. So that can be very overwhelming. And then after that, it starts to stable out probably about after 3 months and really kind of getting into a schedule, trying to find work, and starting on those long-term plans. So that's what we found since release. And we've tried to partner with the attorneys and seeing how to move each case forward individually, what that individual might need to be successful in the community.
So is the work that you're doing as part of the law school different, Rebecca?
Yes, sort of. Basically what happens is once the plan is developed by the Public Defender's Office, put into action, and the person walks out the door, that's kind of where we step in. We have a grant from the Open Society Institute Baltimore to provide case management support for people after they've been released. That can be a variety of services that we provide. Sometimes it's very intensive. There's times, especially with individuals who don't have family members and a lot of family support, they require a little bit more assistance from us, taking them to appointments. We've had situations where people just learning to ride the buses or the metro. So the student, mm-hmm. my students or the case managers have actually ridden along with them so that they can see how it all works. 'Cause all of these things have changed in the ensuing time that they've been.
So you're not getting on the MTA bus putting a quarter in the
not at
thing
all.
No more.
Not at all. So variety of supports. We've had folks that have kind of graduated from our program and then have become ill or gotten, you know, perhaps cancer and come back to us for additional support. So even when the door closes, it's still kind of open.
Mm-hmm. Because the youngest of these men are probably in their 50s. The oldest may be in their 70s, right?
80s.
80s.
I believe 84. Our oldest, 84
is the oldest.
I want to speak on what she was, what Laura was saying about.
Yeah, it's a little close
like
to
Laura was saying about the physical. When I first came home, I went to the hospital like 3 times because every time somebody knocked on the door, I thought they was coming to get me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I thought somebody made a mistake. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, this can't be real. You know, because it's one day you're in my particular case, I'm in a dormitory with elderly other people that are elderly and sick like you are. And
then
in prison. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, you're downtown Baltimore in 90-degree weather with nothing but $18 in your pocket and a T-shirt and some state jeans. And when I got home, I got to the house that my wife provided for me. It was like every time somebody knocked on the door, I would like You know, is they coming to get me?
Did you, like, walk out and have to get home by yourself or somebody waiting for you?
My wife, daughter, and Rebecca and Elizabeth.
Were they waiting?
They were waiting. You know, they were waiting. But that was just briefly. And then after that, me and my wife got in the car and it was just us. And it's like, what are you going to do now? You know, like I said, but I was blessed with family members.
You were very lucky that way.
Even though I'm the eldest in my family, everybody has like fathers and everybody is deceased. And I'm like the oldest member of the family. And I find myself, you know, I'm attending funerals. I have to speak because I'm the oldest of the family. And it's like different roles that I wasn't used to playing. I didn't want to go because, like I said, I felt as though everybody was staring. I mean, we're talking about some of them wasn't even born when I went to prison. And now they're mature adults, like my sons, and they assist me. You know, it was just crazy. It's supposed to be the other way around. When I left, I had to teach my son how to tie his shoes. You know, now he drives me around, cuts my hair. I mean, it's like, it's a big transition. But the physical part is, like I said, I used to wake up in the middle of the night and have these real severe panic attacks. You know, you hear a noise and it's like, you know, I know they're coming to get me. I know this somebody's made a mistake. You know, and it didn't stop till maybe about a year ago. You know, it's ongoing. At times, when I first came home, I was fortunate enough that prior to incarceration, I had a driver's license. Under Maryland's law, if you ever had one, you don't have to go to school or nothing. You can get it right away. So I came home, took the test, and within, 3 weeks, I had my driver's license. And I had access to a vehicle, but I was going to kill somebody because I would drive down the street, and every time I hear the siren or see a police car, I would just stop in the middle of the highway.
Right.
You know,
right.
People say, wait, what are you doing? You know, now I don't do that, but it's a major transition, you know, to come out under the circumstances. But, you know, it like Walter says, it's doable, you know.
We went to get a really short break and come right back. Okay. Pardon my throat here. On the way to break, and Kareem, you're the first caller up. I'm sorry you had to wait. I want to get these stories out first when I come to your call. On the way to break, I want to remind you, Mother's Day is coming. And WEAA is giving you an opportunity to tell your mother how much you love her. Call our Mother's Day Tribute line at 443-885-4293 to give your mother the recognition she deserves in your own way, an on-air tribute. Let's honor our mothers right here on the Voice of the Community, WEAA 88.9 FM at 443-885-4293 and give your mom that tribute. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our conversation talking to the folks involved and men who came out of prison from the Unger decision, who are now free, and what their lives have been like, how the transition has been, how we get there. The man who helped put the Lathers and Transition Program together is Walter Lomax, who joins in the studio, Executive Director of the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, a program of fusion partnerships. And Stanley Mitchell is with us, one of the men who is free now, former prisoner who was released because of the Unger decision, and Rebecca Bowman-Rivas, who is a licensed social worker at the Law and Social Work Service Program at the University of Maryland School, Carey School of Law, and Joni Shreve, who is a licensed social worker as well at the Maryland Office of Public Defender. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Get your thoughts and comments to us here, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can write us an email to talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. And Kareem Hassan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Well, good morning. How are y'all?
Very well. Good morning.
What's up, Hassan?
Yes, well, fortunately, I'm one of them, too. I was on the first low get released on the Unger issue. I spent 37 years, 9 days, and 17 hours in prison. And Ms. Rebecca was my social worker, fortunately.
You said fortunately? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I didn't want to say unfortunately because me and her were beefing from the start because she's a Pittsburgh Steelers fan and I'm a Ravens fan. Yes, but my transition was pretty easy because I had a strong family support system. And I think about 2 months, 3 months after I was out, I got a job working with the city of Baltimore. And I'm still with the city of Baltimore working now. Hello?
And we're listening to you.
Oh, it got real quiet. I thought y'all was going to
That's because we're listening.
Okay, okay. And with me, it was a pretty, like I said, it was a pretty easy transition. And before I came home, what I did, I had a list of my priorities that I wanted to accomplish once I came home. And I first spent time with my family, get back, reacquainted with my family, get my driver's license, get me a job, and all that. Now I've done everything that was on the list. And I'm proud to say that my mother had a chance to see me do them things, because before I went to prison, I was young, wild, and crazy, 17 years old, and really haven't done anything really to make my mother proud of me, except when I was in prison, got my GED, and got in college. That's when I really noticed, really got that feeling of my mother being proud of me. And my mother died 7 months after I was home. But I'm glad she got a chance to see me come home, get a job, get my driver's license, and do something positive, because before she passed, she said, "I'm proud of you, and I'm just happy to be here." And I knew that God granted her wish was for me to come home while she was still alive. And I'm proud to say that happened. And I get really emotional when I talk about my mother.
I understand that. Yeah. If you want to stay with us here for a little bit and hang on, that's great. As we continue this conversation, I think that it's important, I think, for us to kind of hear these stories. And one of the things is to get a sense. I mean, Walter, when you began this project, I remember we talked just after the Unger decision happened, and you were talking about how you would continue devoting the time to come to these meetings on Saturdays and working with men coming out and running a group. And tell me what you've learned out of this experience.
Say it again.
What you have taken from this experience. What have you observed?
A great deal, Mark, a great deal. And Joni and Rebecca was talking. One of the things that we've implemented shortly after they began to be released was an advisory committee. And we were meeting every month. And now we meet bi-monthly to look at and assess how they are making their adjustments, and anybody that has problems or difficulties, or if there's something that needs to be done to address, to assist their transition. We sit at the table, a group of us, social workers, case managers, in some cases, reentry programs, and some of the attorneys on some occasions. And we look at how they are making their adjustment and what we need to do to help facilitate that. What I've gotten out of it, Mark, over time is that is to be a part of changing the narrative about how people talk about these particular individuals. And so now, rather than talking about what sent them to prison or what they were incarcerated for, now they're talking about what they've done while they were incarcerated and what they've been doing since they've been released. And to be a part of actually changing the paradigm, changing the philosophical and theoretical framework as to how people who've been incarcerated are being viewed. And for me, that's been very rewarding to see this process unfold, because at one point they were considered to be a threat to society. Now they're no longer looked at as being a threat to society. And in most cases, they are looked at as being assets to their community. And to be able to use their successful transitions to try to demonstrate for the people that are still incarcerated, as it says, that people do change. And when they change, then we think that they are at the very least deserving of a second chance.
So, one of the things that a couple things strike me here. Go ahead. We're going to say something about it?
Just simply that one thing that's really amazed and impressed me is just watching the way that these folks have kind of bonded together and really provided support and created, and their own community and their own source of support has come through each other. Because I can do a lot of different things. I can help them with getting to an appointment. But honestly, at the end of the day, I don't know what it's like to be inside. And the only people that really understand that are people who have also been inside. And just to see the way that people support each other, they've got their own network. They have community activities that Kareem has been a huge part of facilitating some of that. It's just really been amazing to just watch the community grow and to see the support just among the men and women themselves.
There was one woman in this process.
There was one woman. Right, and I don't want to discount her.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You were going to say, what's Danny, before we...
Like Rebecca was saying, that, you do need strong family support, but also I noticed that when I, like, and Walt was saying, when I first came home, I felt as everybody was staring at me, and I felt as though everybody knew my story, you know. And so I went around some people, like the church people, these church ladies that I know prior to my incarceration. They wouldn't give me the time of day. They'd be on, they see me coming down one side, they'd be on the other side. But I went to church. As I gave my word to my wife, that she said she's going to pray me out, right? So when I got out, I gave my word that I would go to church. So I stalled and said, well, when I get a suit, I'll go. She bought me a suit, so I went to church. And I told some of the ladies my story, and I was thinking that they were going to, like, shy away from me. Instead, they said, that's not my story, that's my testimony, and you need to share that, right? And I said, well, how'd I do that? And so they had me going to Montgomery County, to these youth homes, different places, and I tell my story. And I was always thinking that if I told my true story, my background, that people would gravitate away from me. But instead, they were fascinated, but they also, they said that the boys that I spoke to, it changed their outlook on things, because I tried to explain to them how I got to where I was at and where I'm at today. So as Walter said, that the narrative is changing. When we first came home, it was like, all right, they done let out a bunch of convicted murderers and rapists. And that's what the society was looking for. But the majority of us are old men, you know, I mean, physically and by the calendar. Mm-hmm. And you don't think the same. When I was younger, living in New York, I used to play jumping from rooftops to rooftops. Didn't think nothing about it, but at this age, I think, well, I might get a Charlie horse. I might not make it. So
you might not make it.
The maturity level has changed, so your thought process has changed. And like I said, I found that sharing my story, just, you know, being honest and telling people, this is who I was and this is what I did. You know, and you can make the same choices that I made and you'll get the same consequences. But for society to exist, there has to be rules and you have to abide by them rules. It took me a long time to learn that, but like I said, from sharing my story, the narrative is changing. People are saying, I get a lot of people come up to me and say that I would have never knew that. I would have never knew that you did that. I would have never knew that you were in prison. It's like they think that we come out that we got horns and tails. Now, a lot of us did have horns and tails prior to incarceration, but that's just what we did. That's not who we are as people. So I just wanted to get that out there.
I think there's a text that came in that says, I'll read this to you all and then turn. We haven't heard you for a minute. We'll get back to you right here, and then I have a question for you all. here it is. Janet just wrote in, Mr. Mitchell, it's a miracle to our family to have him home. I'm thankful for the release of my Uncle Stanley. The legal system has a lot of politics, and they get so caught up with crimes instead of handling each case one at a time. Sadly, the same behavior is in the juvenile system as well, which would send fear through my heart. I must say that my uncle, from the beginning of his release, he immediately contacted his loved ones. He has been able to recover, regroup, and stay consistent in being positive in the community. I love him. I'm proud of his success and the community involvement. I'm sure he will continue to educate, mentor, and be part of youth and his peers who has this experience in the legal system. Thanks, Mr. Steiner, for allowing your show to listen to this particular subject, to this particular topic. Love Uncle Stanley's nieces, Janet from Maryland and Najah from New Jersey.
One of them wasn't even born when I went to prison.
But they love you.
How much did you pay him? I'm just kidding.
One of them wasn't even born when I went to prison, and the other one was like a baby, you know. And when I came home, I remember I was in my nephew, this deceased now, Sean, he's 42 years old, he had a heart attack. And he had a home in New Jersey. And when I came home, 2 weeks later, they had a family get together. And there were so many people there. There wasn't even on the planet when I was born, you know, and they only knew what they had heard, you know, that their uncle was, you know, for all intents and purposes, a thug. And so when I came out the bedroom, they were all there, and the look on their face, because, like I said, I'm the oldest in the family, and they seen the physical resemblance, and then they seen me as a person, because I was just somebody that they heard about, you know. So I just made it my mind that I said, you know, I'm not going to disappoint them. You know, I'm going to do my best to be, you know, the uncle that they're looking for. You know, I want to be the father. You know, I want to be, you know, the grandfather. You know, I want to be these things instead of, you know, don't mess with them because they're kin to Stanley Mitchell. As you can see, I'm emotional about that, you know.
Sure.
Because I refer to my nieces, especially the ones you just called, she's more like, in terms of physical appearance, is more like my daughter, because every time I show somebody pictures of my nieces, they say, you can't go to court and deny that they're not yours. I said, no, they're my nieces. They said, no, they got to be your daughters, you know. So, and it's just, like I said, a lot of them wasn't even born when I went to prison. So it's you know, I live for my family now, you know. I just, when I leave here, this planet, I don't want to be known as the, you know, the family member to spend so many years in prison and the lifestyle that I had prior to prison. I want to be known for who I am today. And like I said, I'm far from perfect. I done made some mistakes even since I've been home. But they're hiccups compared to, you know, who I was, the person before. And they give me, you know, the motivation to get up every day at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, and go out and do what I have to do. You know, my family gives me the desire to be in the house when it's at 12 o'clock every night, you know. I really appreciate, you know, her coming in, because she's, you know, I mean, they expressed it to me, but it's just amazing, you know, that, you know, if you just do what you're supposed to do, you know, not what you have to do, but what you're supposed to do, how doors open for you, not only with family, but even, like I said, when I go in the store where I live at, you know, I'm Mr. Mitchell. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's just amazing how the transition has been, you know.
Because you haven't been Mr. Mitchell for a long time.
No. You know, it's just amazing that, you know, how if you, like I said, I don't want to keep saying the same thing, but it's a fact. If you do the right thing, people do, you know, life is better.
And so, Johnny, let me get your voice back in here before I ask this question. So, I mean, I'm curious what you've taken from this as well. I mean,
every time I look at the cases that I've had the opportunity to work on, heard people's stories and help them through this transition, listening to Stanley, I'm always struck by the power of hope in their stories. And, you know, you look at when we look back and see who this person was when they were 17, 18, 19 years old, and the transformation that's happened to now looking at a 65-year-old man, the perspective that he's had on his journey and his story, hope is always a part of that journey. And they may not have known for sure if they would ever be able to come home and be a part of their families and give back in the way that they knew that they could give back. But many never gave up the hope of that becoming a possibility. And I think one of the most important parts of this Unger story is the hope that it brought back to people who are still inside, and the opportunity to come back and be a part of their family members, to become caretakers and to become, you know, part of our community by working and giving back. I think that's really the heart of the story.
So, one of the things I think about when I was realizing y'all were coming on today and reading the articles about the people who've been imprisoned since they were 16, 17 years old, convicted of murder or whatever they were convicted of. I mean, what does it say about, in a larger sense, our criminal justice system? I mean, there's all, you know, I've read pieces that some of the victims' families have said and upset that certain people were allowed out of prison. I mean, and deeply upset people were allowed out of prison. And that's a real emotion and reality, too. And we have a culture that says if you have committed a certain crime, then you have to give up your life forever and put you away. But when I think of the all the men and some women that I've known that have come out of prison after years and years and years and years, that and you look at the human beings they become, after 20, 30 years or whatever that number is in prison, how lives shift. I mean, how do you think about – what does that say about, A, how we have to shift our system of justice in terms of what we where it should be going, and also what the healing process is as well? Because people have to heal from being in prison. People have to heal who've been victims as well. Do you know what I'm saying? So this is not an easy thing.
It certainly isn't an easy thing. I want to test three quick points. First is Stanley. I have a sense of humor, and so forgive that.
Unfortunately.
No, it works pretty good for me. Right? And the other thing is that we certainly pay a lot of attention to the victims. We certainly do. We have a group of ladies belong to an organization called Save Survivors Against Violence Everywhere. I used to attend cookouts. I met them shortly after I was released, and they've appeared in some of the documentaries that we've done. And I would attend events that they would have and cookouts that they would have. And since the people that were being released under the Unger decision, I was at an event. Well, they also hold annual gatherings down at Carroll Park. And I was at an event about 2 years ago with the women whose sons were murdered in Baltimore City. The organization is called Survivors Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE. And they asked me, said, well, why are they down there and we are up here? Why aren't they up here? And I made a conscious effort to the next year was to bring the groups together. And last year, they attended the event that the men had, and they were so overwhelmed with the compassion and the support that they gave them, that they showed them that they were literally in tears. And so we do pay a lot of attention to the victims. I, from a personal perspective, I lost my younger brother to violence in Baltimore City. He was murdered in 1982. And one of my grandsons was murdered in Baltimore City in 2006, the year that I was released. So my family and I personally know how devastating that can be. So it's not something that we take lightly. It really isn't. You know, however, listen to Hassan, and when he spoke about he was 17 years old when he went to prison and the mindset that he had that when he was there. And then when we look at him, how he is today, the maturation process. And this is invariably what happens to people when they go to prison, specifically younger people, and even older people, too, are subject to change. But focusing specifically on Hassan and the juvenile issue of people that are young, that if we indict every individual for the rest of their life for a mistake that they made, then there would be no incentive for them to change. I think it was Judge Motz that made a court ruling. He said that hope and the longing for reward lie at the heart of every human endeavor. In its absence, there's no reason to change. And so from a personal perspective, I believe that if you treat an individual with dignity and respect, that they will respond in kind. And so in reference to Joni's statement is that hope, because to me, hope, faith and with hope, faith and belief, anything is possible. And I'm saying that even the most egregious act, I think that individual is still deserving of a second chance, because we are human beings, and I don't think that we are in a position to make that ultimate call. I think that that's a call that has to be made by God, by Allah, some higher power. But we as men, we as human beings, it says a great deal about our society, about how we just tend to throw people away.
Folks, do join us. We just saw a couple calls came and went, but you come back and call 410-319-8888. We'll get you on the air.
Make a comment? Sorry.
Oh, no, please go ahead.
To go off of what Walter was saying, too, is that one of the things to remember with this population is that most, if not all, of these sentences were life with the possibility of parole when they were handed down. Many were at times recommended for parole by the parole commission, and it was not approved by the governor at the time. Many of the sentences that people are still serving from the 70s and 80s that are parole eligible in practice are more of a life without the possibility of parole sentence. So it complicates our understanding of I think what justice is and what is an appropriate sentence. When at the time the sentence was given, there was an understanding that parole would be a very real possibility if that person did what they needed to do in the institution and made progress.
We have another email that came in. Let me read this for you all. Dear Mr. Steiner, thank you for covering this story with the respect and interest it deserves. I am always grateful for the chance I got to begin working with a project at UMB in January 2013. And my last 3.5 years with the project have shaped both my practice and my beliefs. I am privileged to work with these people and this project. Thank you, Liz Smith, who just wrote in as well. So,
that's our stepmother.
That's your stepmother?
Yeah, that's all my stepmother. She's like a mother hen. You know, she's always...
Come a little closer to the mic, Sammy.
She's like her and Miss Rebecca, like, you know, the mother hen. If we do something that we ain't got no business doing, they'll correct you. And if you need help, they also correct you. But I also want to say, like what Joni was saying and Walter saying about Hope, everybody that I run across and I express my history to, and the amount of time that I was incarcerated, which fascinates them, and they're like, well, how did you do it? You know, they always say what they would have done. I would have killed myself. I can't do that. And I tell them that what kept me focused and kept me going, that I always felt as though somebody in society, a family member or a friend at that particular time, always cared whether I lived or died. So when you get in prison, if you know that nobody cares about you, you lose all hope. You're not getting the system's not giving you no hope. You're doing what you're supposed to do, but they're still closing the doors. I'm one of the people that Walter was talking about. I got recommended parole in 1991. It took me 20 years later before I was released. So you need hope. You need hope from the system, knowing that if you made a mistake, you do the right thing, you can get out. You need hope, knowing that somebody in society cares whether you live or die. And that's what I tell people, that, you know, I made it because I've always had somebody that I can call. Before you had phones, I always had somebody that I could call, not for the money, not for the commissary, but they cared, you know, how I was doing and if I was still alive. And that was what you need. You need hope from the system, but you also need hope from people that care about you. Like Walt said, you know, you can't judge a person their whole life by, in some cases, more than one act that they did that they shouldn't have, you know. And as far as keeping people in prison 30, 40 years, like I did 30, Walt did close to 40, it's like, it's senseless. It's senseless. I mean, if you know, I always tell people, I say, you know, if you're not going to ever let them out, then they better off dead. But then there's a higher power that I say this, that if I was that bad a person, then the higher power, I wouldn't be here. So I always say, and my family tells me, and my church members and people that I serve say, well, somebody got a plan for you. God got a plan for you. Oh, you wouldn't be here. Because there's no reason for me to, the lifestyle I lived, there's no reason for me to still be here. You know, so I'm trying to make, you know, I'm trying to do what they told me when I left, have the best life that I can and make people, not make them, but people that I come in contact with, be glad that I'm no longer in the cage.
And it's, let me go to the phone. And a quick call in here before we run out of time. And I guess I'm on the phone here. 410-319-8888 is a number. Owusu, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. It's a really powerful program. I was affiliated at Southern University in Baton Rouge before retirement, and we did a volunteer program with the juveniles around gardening establishment and horticultural practices. And I was wondering, do your guests have access to maybe mentor folks who are currently incarcerated? Can they visit those individuals and provide guidance? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks so much for what you do.
Who wants to jump in?
In fact, Stanley does as well, but I visit the institutions all over the state of Maryland. In fact, we have coordinators in all the institutions where we distribute updated information on the work that we are doing on the outside, and they meet on a regular basis themselves. And so a great deal of work is being done. Unfortunately, but we have not at this point been successful in creating the vehicle where from the work that they are doing on the inside, that there's a transition for them to return back into the community. That stopgap prevents that from happening. And so, again, going back to hope and reward lie at the heart of every human endeavor, these individuals continue to thrive and continue to do good in spite of the system, not necessarily because of it. but we do a lot of work in that area.
You know, I go back to the prisons. Oh.
I'm just going to have a couple minutes. I just want to say for you.
I know, obviously, from the amount of time that I was incarcerated, I know a lot of people that are still incarcerated. And there's a lot of people that I would like to do things for. I can't send everybody money orders. You know, I can't visit everybody. So I go back in there, and one of the individuals, I go, he said, man, I don't see how you do it. After all the time you spend in here, you know, why would you come back in here, you know, to see me and see other people? It's because I want them to get what somebody gave me, hope. Because they see me and they know me. I mean, I slept in the same cell with them, the same dormitory, and now they see me in society. And I felt bad because I didn't want to, like, come in there and say, look at me. You know, but they like that because it says, man, if you got your shot, I'm going to get my shot. And so as a result, I tell them that, you know, it does matter whether you get stupid infractions. It does matter whether you do dumb stuff while you in here. You know, because when you come out, you know, people ask you about that. You know, I get the question, well, what did you do while you were in there? So, like I said, that's my way of giving back to my peers that I left behind.
Now, this is I'm glad we had a chance to have this discussion today and bring this out here, and I'm glad that Walter kind of poked and prodded and got in touch to say, can we do this? Because I think it's really important for us to wrestle with. And for me, this is also fuel to the fire of our continuing looks at criminal justice reform and how we manage our criminal justice system, the change we need in our communities here in Baltimore City so people do not become incarcerated, and also what happens to men and women in prison are not just throwaways, and think about the ways that we can have a system of restorative justice and people paying for what they did, but paying in a way that doesn't destroy every life around them and everybody else as well. So I think this has been kind of very inspirational that we've been covering this since the very beginning. And I want to thank all of our guests today. Let me thank Stanley Mitchell. Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much for being able
to share your story. I want to thank Kareem Hassan for calling in as well. My good friend Walter Mandela Lomax, for coming here in the studio. As Executive Director of the Maryland Restorative Justice Initiative, a program of fusion partnerships. It's good to have you here, man. Thank you so much for the work
Thanks,
you do.
Thanks, Mark. I'd like to close with just saying, man, let's continue the dialogue.
You have to continue the dialogue. Continue the dialogue open. I want to thank both Rebecca Bowman Rivas from the University of Maryland School of Law, where she's a social worker, and Joni Shrevey, who is social worker with the Maryland Office Public Defender, for their work in this program. Thank you both for lending your voices today as well.
Thank you.
And I will remind you all, tomorrow night I'll be speaking on a panel called Transform, the Future of Justice and Knowledge of the Red Line. And that's redlining, not just the redlining of Baltimore. It's the concluding part of a four-part series on redlining Baltimore that was hosted by Johns Hopkins University and John Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative, and bringing together academics, activists, and residents to discuss what discrimination has done in our community and how we change the future, which is what we'll be speaking about tomorrow night at 6. So I'll be joined by Dr. Lester Spence and Michael Cryer. It's tomorrow at 6 p.m. at Parks and People Foundation, 2100 Liberty Heights Avenue. So do join us there for that live discussion and participation. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And the podcast, Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.